Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guests would like to know, which millionaire are you voting for? That was the title of an October 13th New York Times op-ed by my guest, Professor Nicholas Carnes, who writes that in Congress, state legislators, even municipal offices, working class and blue-collar employees make up only 2 to 3% of office holders, but yet make up a majority of our labor force, some 90 million jobs in the economy. Carnes is currently working on a book that examines how the shortage of people from the working class is skewing policymaking processes towards outcomes that favor the upper class's economic interests. And that puts a new spin on the argument that money is corrupting the political process. If, in fact, Carnes' hypothesis is correct, legislators are simply representing their own interest. Nicholas Carnes is an assistant professor of public policy at Duke University. He was a graduate of Princeton University, where he was a Wilson Scholar Fellow, a Princeton University Fellow, and the recipient of a Congressional Research Award from the Dirksen Congressional Center. His undergraduate degree comes from the University of Tulsa, where he majored in political science, and he was a recent guest of the University of Tulsa, giving the Distinguished Alumni Lecture on Law and Politics. I spoke with him while he was here. Professor Nicholas Carnes is my guest today. Nicholas Carnes, welcome back to Tulsa and welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining
us. Oh, thanks so much for having me.
You're doing some very interesting research at Duke University, which is looking at, well, your op-ed said it all. In the election, you say, which millionaire are you voting for? And it really looks at how our elected representatives, there are such enormous class distinctions between the average middle class person and the people that represent them.
Absolutely. Like I say in the op-ed, if millionaires were a political party, they'd be 3% of the country and would have unified control of the White House, Congress, and the Supreme Court.
So what led you down this path of looking at income inequality and how it affects representation?
To be completely honest, I grew up in a small town in southeast Kansas and then eventually wound up at Princeton University. And I saw, social class, I think, from both sides. I was in graduate school with classmates who owned airplanes and owned hotel chains. And it really helped me appreciate that even though, on paper, politically, we all look, pretty similar, there were big differences in how we thought about the economy, how we thought about sort of bread and butter issues. And, I was in a political science program and I started asking myself, what happens if this same group of people were to run Congress? And I started looking at the data. And sure enough, Princeton grads make up a huge percentage of Congress relative to what they do in the population as a whole. And the more I looked at the data, the more I saw, gosh, any measure you care about, wealth, what type of occupation the person had, what type of education they got. Our political institutions look very, very different from the country as a whole.
How do they look different? Give us a sense. You said education, wealth. Give us a sense. What are the occupations? I think most people would think attorneys.
Attorneys make up a huge share of institutions like Congress. So take working class jobs. Let's say manual labor jobs, service industry jobs. That's a little over half of our economy. More than half of the country works in what I would call working class jobs. And if you were to take the average member of Congress and ask, how much of your life have you spent in these jobs that make up a majority of our labor force? It's about 1.5%. The average member of Congress spent the equivalent of one summer in high school working in the jobs that are a majority of our labor force. And, the question I started asking is, does that affect how they see the economy? Does that affect how they think about the issues? My view is if you want to make a complicated decision – like how to run the most powerful country in the world, you want people who can look at the issues from every possible angle. You don't want to throw out the lawyers. You don't want to throw out the business owners. But you want someone who understands the economy from a different angle, not just from the top. And so I started researching this topic and finding, yeah, it really matters who's calling the shots and whether they understand the working class.
Give us a sense of how broad this study is. Is it mainly Congress that you've been looking at, or have you been looking at Congresses, state houses, municipalities? How far have you been going on this research? Because I'd be interested to know, not necessarily service and working class jobs, but even good middle class jobs like teachers, like middle managers or things like that. Are they represented at all in our governing class?
So as you start to move up into, you know, sort of these middle class jobs, the situation doesn't look quite so bleak. But it is still the case that Congress is mostly lawyers and big business people, people who are CEOs, people who are owners of companies. And this isn't just a federal government issue. This is also something that we see nationwide in our state houses. This is something we even see in our city councils. And I've tried to look at data from every level of government, from every time period that I can find. And across the board, I'm seeing everywhere I look the same basic patterns. The people in charge are disproportionately being drawn from sort of the very well-off. And they're making decisions that look different than the kinds of decisions we would think, you know, a middle-class person or a working-class person would make. So Congress is maybe 1.5% working class. The average city council is about 10% working class people. And that's still, you know, there's still a huge gap between the average city council and the average American.
And think of the political arc from going from a city council to maybe the state house as a state representative or state senator to a federal office holder. That's a big leap, too.
Absolutely. Yeah. So after, you know, once you go from city to state house, the percentage, say, working class drops from 10 to more like 3 or 4. And then when you get up to the level of Congress, I mean, once you go up to the federal level, there's almost no one in government who understands working class jobs, who's actually worked with their hands, who's actually punched a time card. And that bothers some people just on a purely symbolic level. There are some people who say, you know, I think the government should look like the people it represents. And the point of my research is, over and above that, you know, sort of symbolic level, there are real policy stakes. Economic policy would look different. It would be less pro-business and more pro-worker if our policymakers were drawn from sort of the same mix of classes or occupations as the rest of us.
Well, when you think of the barriers for working class individuals or even, you know, white collar middle class people from entering into taking a run for elective office, you know, you just have to look at one big symbol, and that's a dollar sign.
Absolutely.
It's incredibly expensive to run for Congress. It's getting increasingly expensive to run for even the state house and even municipal elections. You're seeing more and more money come into the system. And certainly Supreme Court rulings have loosened that as far as the role money plays in political campaigns. Is that the simple answer why you see so few people try to do this?
I think it's a big part of the answer. I think the rise of sort of mega spending in our political process has moved the situation from bad to worse. So as a part of my research, I interviewed a guy named Congressman Edward Beard, and he represented the 2nd District in Rhode Island in the 1970s. And he was a true working class person. He was a house painter up until the time he entered the U.S. House.
Wow.
He quit his house painting job to be sworn in to the U.S. Congress.
How does somebody like that, even in the 1970s, win election?
What he did is he raised the whopping sum of $900, and then he walked every day after work, walked door to door, knocking on doors and telling people what was going on in Providence, what was going on in the state legislature, and how he would do things differently. He literally led a truly grassroots campaign. The $900 he spent was almost all on shoes because he was literally pounding the pavement. Now, I asked him, I said, could you do what you did in the 1970s today? And he said, no. It would be almost impossible. Back then, it was nearly impossible. And today, the money is just making stories like that inconceivable.
Well, you know, the one thing I can remember is in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, seeing the candidate walk, you know, and I'm not talking about a congressional candidate so much as a state house candidate. That's a manageable number of constituents they represent in a state like Oklahoma. But I can't remember the last time I had a candidate walking through the neighborhood. It doesn't happen all that much. Is it just a matter it's easier to raise money and do, you know, media blitzes in one form or another as opposed to doing retail politicking?
You know, I think the problem in a lot of cases is that if you walk door to door, the other guy is going to outspend you tenfold. And, you know, while you're pounding the pavement, there are going to be televised ads, there are going to be mailers. So the money just makes it hard to do politics the old way, because it is so – with money, you can reach people almost effortlessly, and that is taking the place of this sort of classic idea of a politician who knocks on your door and tells you to your face what their positions are. Nowadays, they have to fundraise. They have to be able to match ads, you know, on television, on the radio, on in the papers. And so, you know, that same politician, if he or she wants to win, has to do some fundraising, has to go to the fancy dinners, has to pound a different kind of pavement. And that's the pavement in between the big donors' houses.
Now, I know there have been a number of candidates who basically said, I'm going to issue special interest money. You know, you'll see candidates that say, I'm not going to take any more than $100 in a donation. And most of those times, they run really good campaigns, but they don't win. They come close. And then certainly in the 2000s, there were several high-profile congressional races and even a Senate race in New England where they came really close. And there was this idea of retail politicking.
Right.
The people were of modest means themselves. And basically said, I'm not going to run a ton of money, raise a ton of money to run. You know, I don't think any of them, very few of them, if any, got elected. I think the only ones that got elected had deep pockets themselves.
Right, right. That's the other side of this is now maybe you don't have to have a well-financed campaign, but you have to be a well-financed individual.
And that's a big change in American politics over the course of our history. If you were wealthy,
change.
You basically had somebody you were backing to run for Congress. You stayed out of the public sector.
Yeah. Yeah. The important point is these days it's very hard to run the kind of campaign you described where you don't have deep pockets yourself and you're not relying on friends with deep pockets. It's just hard to win that way. But even before all this, it was still very difficult for a person who's genuinely of modest means, genuinely from the working class, you know, go back 100 years and Congress was then still only about 2% working class. And so that's why I said the rise of money, the rise of both wealthy people running or people financed by wealthy people has, I think, moved the situation from bad to worse. But it was bad before. Even before, you know, a political campaign was a multi-million dollar extravaganza, there were still barriers that kept working people out of the political process.
Now I'm going to ask a very provocative question. Isn't that the way the Constitution set it up in the first place? Because if you remember, the qualification for vote under the Constitution originally was you were a landowner.
That's right. And you know, amend that requirement.
Not to mention, you know, women, people of color, working class people who worked in a job and rented a room in a boarding house need not bother with voting. I mean, that's what the Constitution was set up.
And I'm not here to pick on the framers of the U.S. Constitution. But, you know, even amend those things out of our Constitution. So you know, flash forward to the middle of the 20th century and we've got universal suffrage. Even then, it's still really tough for women to get elected. It's still really tough. I mean, women are still underrepresented. Racial, ethnic minorities are still underrepresented. It's not purely about just extending the franchise, extending votes to people. There are other barriers in our political process. Like I said, I'm not here to pick on the founders of the country. I'm here to say there are features of our political process over and above, you know, we can fix those parts of the Constitution. We have fixed those parts of the Constitution, and there are still challenges. There are still features of our political process.
The only reason I brought that up was because, I mean, I realize that a lot have changed since 1789, but I think the popular perception is now that anybody can grow up to be president. That was a great adage in the 20th century. I
right.
think nowadays people just say that's hopelessly naive. But anybody could go up to be a congressman, to be a senator.
Right.
And that's the popular perception. But probably nowhere in our history has that really been proven the rule rather than an incredible exception.
That's exactly right. Again, go back, look at the entire post-war period. Look at the 1940s to the present day. Nobody has left a working class job, gotten into politics, and become president. Very, very few people have left a working class job, gotten into politics, and become a member of Congress.
Harry Truman is probably the closest person to a working
right.
class guy, and he was a failed haberdasher and became a basically the equivalent of a county commissioner.
Right.
And became a senator, then became vice president and president. That is probably one of the most exceptional stories in our American political history.
And we remember Truman because he is the exception that proves the rule. Yeah, he's the last president we had who didn't have a college degree. Why is that so interesting and so memorable? Because it's almost unthinkable that somebody from modest means would would succeed in the political process where so much is stacked against them.
My guest today is Nicholas Carnes. He's an assistant professor of public policy at Duke University, a graduate of the University of Tulsa, and then later Princeton. He was a guest of the University of Tulsa giving the Distinguished Alumni Lecture in Law and Politics, and we're happy to welcome back to Tulsa. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, because you're writing about an issue that is one of those real hot-button issues that really doesn't get discussed much, and when people do discuss it in our current political debate, those people tend to get marginalized, and that is the P word, and that's plutocracy. And people do not really want to talk about government by and for the rich. You're starting to see people really talk about this, and oftentimes those voices are marginalized. Is this a fear that we have a plutocracy, or we're on the verge of getting a plutocracy where basically working class people are really priced out of the system?
You know, I think it's something that makes a lot of people uncomfortable because it runs so contrary to values that are so dear to everybody on the left and the right. And so you know, to sort of talk about plutocracy is, I think, to some people, to question sort of political ideals that are just fundamental to the way we think about ourselves as a country. You know, I think it's an important conversation to have. I think even though it makes us uncomfortable, we should ask questions about. I think you can ask the question, do we have government that represents everyone, without questioning the fundamental value of our political process? But I do think there are people who, they hear plutocracy and they think, this person wants to throw the whole system out. This is somebody who doesn't respect anything about our political process. And, you know, you can go on the internet and find people who say this is a plutocracy. It's you know, throw the whole thing away. But I think as we're starting to deal with this more carefully and more thoughtfully, we're starting to see people realize, no, you can ask questions about whose interests government is representing without sort of, you know, questioning the core of our political process. So a lot of the reforms I'm advocating, I'm not saying throw away our political institutions. I'm saying, let's try to devise programs to support working class candidates. I'm not saying throw out Congress. I'm saying we should think about the things that are keeping working class people from getting into Congress and try to solve those within the constitutional framework we already have.
So let's talk about some of your reforms. Can you describe some of the things you'd like to see to get a more representative Congress or a more representative state house?
I should preface this by saying a lot of these aren't actually my reforms. There are already people who have been working on this a lot longer than I have, and they've had a lot of success. And what it basically looks like is let me use an example. The AFL-CIO in New Jersey has a program. It's a nonpartisan program. They recruit Republicans and Democrats and Libertarians and everybody. And what they do is they identify people who do blue-collar jobs who are politically inclined. They're interested in politics, they're paying attention, they have, you know, what we might think of as candidate potential. And they talk to them about running, they help them make sure that that they won't lose their job by participating in American civic life. And they train them on how to run a campaign with not a lot of money. And the whole program runs on a shoestring budget. Their hard costs are about $500,000, which to you and me is a lot. But in New Jersey, politics is it's 1% of what John Corzine spent to run for the U.S. Senate in New Jersey.
Right.
So in political terms, a modest sum. Every year, they send about 100 people into different levels of government, from city council on up to the state house. And they have a 75% success rate. The people who go through their program win about 75% of the time. Most of them have long careers in politics. And they do all of this without throwing out the system. They do all of this without sort of restructuring the way New Jersey government is run. It's, you know, sort of basic political advocacy.
Mm-hmm. So in that case, so you have a union, which, of course, whether you believe it or not, unions do have a diversity of opinion with them, even though
Absolutely.
The popular rhetoric is that it is completely bought, and perhaps the leadership usually do ally themselves with Democratic policies. But I would think that you wouldn't see a lot of bipartisan efforts out of a union. Are there other organizations that perhaps have a more bipartisan reputation they're doing things.
Absolutely.
Like this.
I mean, you could set up a program that worked just like this. You know, so say you go to a state like North Carolina, where they're, you know, the unions are very small in political terms. You could set up a program exactly like the one they run. You know, start a new organization, form a completely bipartisan organizing committee, and you could take their model and most likely import it into other places. And yeah, if you're uncomfortable with the labor union running a program like this, anyone can set up a program like this. I mean, you know, you need certain tools and you need startup money. But what you don't need is to throw out the whole political process.
Have you talked to candidates that have bucked this trend of being either working class or staunchly middle class that have been able to jump into politics and be successful? Have you met some candidates like that?
Yeah, in the course of my research, I talked to candidates and successful politicians from the working class.
What do they see as the biggest obstacles to having a more diverse Congress or state house?
So they point to a lot of things. First, you know, it's just tough to leave a good job to run for public office, which is a risky, you know, undertaking. Now, if you're a lawyer, you can take a leave of absence from your practice and run for state legislature. And in the process, you're promoting yourself and you're promoting your practice. And so professionally, it's good for you. But if you work in a factory, it can be very tough to leave that job to run for public office.
Shoot, I can think of a lot of firms, like a teacher, an accountant working
teacher
in a accountant working in a firm where if you leave, somebody's going to have to take up your slack. And probably they're going to have to hire somebody to replace you while you're taking that leave of absence.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, you're gone.
And your position might not be there when you get back. And I think that's part of the reason why you have so many, you know, so many people, say, from law who go into public offices, because professionally for them it's not a liability the way it is for lots of other people. And that's, I think, also part of why you have people who are just independently wealthy, who made all the money they're ever going to need.
Or self-employed.
Or self-employed, exactly. People who can take time off without potentially wrecking a career they've worked hard at. And I think that's one of the challenges that I hear most often. The other is just not knowing where to start in the political process. If you don't know the chair of your county party, if you don't know the chair of the Republican Party of Tulsa County or the Democratic Party of Tulsa County, it could be hard to know just where to start. And so a lot of what, say, you know, this program in New Jersey is all about is really outreach, is really just connecting politically interested people to the sort of gatekeepers who know how the system works, who know how, you know, how a candidate can get involved in the political process in the first place. What I hear a lot of the time is once you get into politics, it's actually pretty straightforward. The hard part is just that initial learning curve of knowing who the key players are and how the whole process works.
Let me ask you another question. Do you think that working class people, people middle of class, do you think they have even the interest to go into politics? Because, you know, politics doesn't have the sterling reputation that it had maybe 50, 60 years ago, where the honorable public servant, there's pretty much a derogatory feel about most politicians being a politician.
Absolutely.
Do you think people that see the system is really not working in their economic interest want to get involved to change it?
In my own experience, the people who see the system that way are often the most eager to get involved, because they say, you know what, I've got a problem with the way this is working, but I can be a part of the solution. And so, you know, I find that the people who are the biggest critics of politics as usual are often the most eager to get in there and do things differently. That's my two cents. But, you know, in general, one of the things I've looked at in my research, are there politically qualified working class people out there? And you can look at big surveys. You can look at public opinion surveys, political knowledge surveys, and they're out there. Absolutely. In numbers so big that they often surprise people who actually work in politics for a living. I can, you know, put some data on the screen and show, and they say, really, there's that many people who, you know, have a high level of political knowledge, who talk about politics every day. I say, absolutely. So what my research says is there's not really the, you know, it's not a qualifications deficit that's keeping working class Americans out of public office. It's something else. It's something about the startup costs of getting into politics in the first place. Because once working class people get into their first political office, they tend to succeed. They tend to have political careers that are just as long as the political career of, you know, a first term lawyer or a first term business owner. So you know, my research says there's a huge untapped potential in the working class.
You're working on this book. When is the book due out? Are you far along in this research? Or are you halfway through or getting close to putting together your final conclusions or what exactly?
So my first research project was really to ask the question, does it matter? Does it matter that there are almost no working class people in public office? Does it matter that, for the most part, millionaires run the country? And that project is wrapping up. So the book is under contract, and you know, if I'm lucky, it'll be on the shelves in a year. You know, could be as long as 18 months.
What's the next questions in your research?
Yeah, the next research question is really pinning down what exactly is keeping working class people out of public office. So I think I've convinced myself, and I think I've convinced some of the critics of the research. I think I've convinced people that it matters that there are almost no working class people in public office. So the next project is, why aren't they there? What's keeping the working class out of political office in the United States? And that's a big project. So right now we're fielding surveys of political candidates. I'm conducting interviews with people who are really running or thinking about running. And what I'm going to try to do is pin down the factors that are really doing the work. There are a million theories out there. There are as many theories as there are, people I talk to in the airport. The hard part is pinning down what exactly is doing the work and what can we do about it? Is there an answer here? There's a school of thought that says this is a totally intractable problem. There's a school of thought that says, well, voters just don't like candidates from the working class. Well, I've got data that says that's not true. I think I've ruled out that when working class people run for public office, they do about as well as anybody else. What voters really care about is where you stand on the issues and what you're going to do once you get into office. I think I've ruled that out. There's also, a lot of people have said to me, well, they're not qualified. That's why working class people don't run. And I've looked at the data, and what the data say is, no, actually, there are lots and lots of literally millions of working class Americans who, as far as we can tell, there are some things you just can't measure. But with the things we can measure, qualifications don't seem to be the problem either. So the hard part is...
Well, that brings us to money.
That brings us to things like money, things like access to political gatekeepers, and that's really the harder part. It's relatively easy to look at candidates and to see how they do. And you can test relatively easily whether voters don't like candidates from the working class. The harder part is getting into these processes that are a little murkier, a little more behind the scenes. But that's sort of the next stage of this research, is figuring out exactly what's screening working class Americans out. And can we do anything about it? And I'm still optimistic that we can. To go back to this program in New Jersey, they train working class people on politically the equivalent of a shoestring budget, and they have great success. And these people go on and have wonderful careers in New Jersey politics. And I look at something like that and I say, okay, New Jersey is not a microcosm of the entire country.
And it's a very expensive state to run for office
it's,
in.
It's the most densely populated state in the country. It is by definition atypical on a lot of dimensions. But, if the sort of millionaires club, if it's not invincible in New Jersey, it's probably not invincible in other places. And so that's the next leg of this research, is to see whether I'm right on that count. And I hope I am.
Well, we wish you great success with that. Nicholas Carnes, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Nicholas Carnes is an assistant professor of public policy at Duke University, and he was a guest of the University of Tulsa. He is an alumnus of the university, giving the Distinguished Alumni Lecture in Law and Politics last week. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.